Okay, I want to get started with the presentation. So, you know, I've done research presentations, I think, at almost every analytics conference here. Most of them usually are driven around data and so forth. This is more of a concept I'm sharing. It's not a data-based. It's more of a framework that I wanted to share with folks. And it has to do, and it really pivots directly off of the previous panel in that it focuses on the distinction between performance at a minor league level, let's say, for a prospect, and his potential. And I think those are very important. It's a very important distinction. So I want to kind of walk through a framework that perhaps teams can use, and I'm sure some of them are using something similar today, that can help them tease out potential for future growth of talent and performance from existing and current performance at the minor league level. I guess you could also think of it at the amateur level as well. You know, what problem am I trying to solve? Well, the problem is that player development resources are clearly limited, no question. And allocating those resources to the highest potential talent would help improve the return on investment of those resources. The other thing is, I think the problem I'm trying to solve is that I think performance and potential for young players are often conflated. There's not a great enough distinction between, okay, he did this, but does that really portend the capability for this at a higher level? And then finally, I think significant value can be created by a deeper distinction between current performance and future potential and what the markers of each of those are. So I think value is created by ensuring that resources are dedicated to the high potential talent, and that we can define specific attributes that can help us develop a customized performance plan, development plan, if you will, for the high-po talent. What I'm going to do is I'm going to borrow from a framework that's commonly used in human resources practices in corporate America and talk about that process very briefly up front, just to set the stage, and then to show you how I think baseball player development organizations can fit into it quite neatly, and there's, I think, a good analogy there. So the objective is I want to use some of these best practice tools and adapt them to what I think makes sense for a player development system, and present this framework to make a clearer distinction between performance and potential, and then share ways to measure each of those three things, and or performance and potential in particular, so that we can make that distinction. So I'm going to talk about assessing talent in a corporate context very briefly, talk about the 9-box grid, which is the tool I was referring to, and adapt it to baseball, break down some performance metrics, and then looking at the skills and attributes that are really designed that are more focused on potential. So, you know, one of the problems in a corporate context is that it's highly subjective when you're evaluating potential. It's usually the evaluator's boss who is making that judgment. Maybe the HR folks are involved to a degree, but it's often the person that you're working for. So that potential in a corporate context for an employee of an organization is typically unduly influenced by current performance and the employee's, you know, person who's reviewing him or making that judgment. But the assessment criteria are, you know, think of it as in three ways. One is you're going to be judged well for future jobs if you're mastering the technical knowledge at the current role you're in, okay? You're also, you know, tends to be in a corporate environment that jobs of increasing responsibility have greater complexity associated with them. These are management jobs I'm speaking about. So that your critical thinking skills might be singled out. Your problem-solving skills and your ability to deal with more complexity might be singled out as another criteria. And then the third thing are the leadership skills. Oftentimes, elevating in a management career means that you have people responsibility, and so the skills that are the attributes such as empathy, building trust, accepting accountability, ability to galvanize people around common goals are the kinds of things that in a corporate environment would speak to potential. Now, it's quite different, of course, in a baseball world. So in baseball, to translate this to player development, I think we have to understand which elements of performance are consistent with success at higher levels. Create as much separation as possible between performance and potential metrics, and then utilize this 9-box grid. So the 9-box grid, very simply, looks like this. It's got performance up the vertical axis, low, medium, and high, and potential on the horizontal axis, low, medium, and high, from left to right. So to show you what that might mean, and think of this still in a corporate context, I'm going to show you the baseball context on the next slide. But if you're in that lower left category, it means you're performing poorly and you really don't typify someone who has strong potential, then you're perhaps a misfit in the organization and you're probably a candidate for outplacement. If you're a medium performer but don't show a lot of potential, well, you know, you may be an asset to the organization in a specific role, but if you have ambitions to grow significantly, you may be misplaced in this role. So that's an issue more for the employee in that instance. On the top left, which is a valuable asset in the role or level, at the current level, this is someone who's performing really well, and we've all seen these people in jobs that we work in, but you don't necessarily see them having the stretch to do even their boss's job, not to mention their boss's boss's job and so forth. Then you start moving across the to the right, and let's start at the bottom, center, middle. This is an employee you want to coach to help improve their performance in their current role. If you jump up to the top of that, now you're talking about someone who's performing at a high level and has medium potential, as your assessment says, so they're probably promotable at least one level. And then if you look at the two right top boxes, we're talking about high potential individuals who are performing at either a medium or high level and have been assessed to have a lot of the qualities that it takes to succeed at their boss's job or their boss's boss's job. If you're in that bottom right category, which is an odd place to be, it means you're performing at a very low level, but it means you've been assessed previously to have lots of potential. So at that point, it's time for a reassessment, I mean, a recalibration at a minimum. But let's talk baseball. So in baseball, if you're in that bottom left category, you're probably tapped to be designated for assignment, released, non-tendered, because you're just not really filling an organizational need, and you don't really predict that you're going to advance much beyond where you are. If you move up a box, now you've got a medium performer who has low potential, perhaps you can fill spots at the minor league level to balance the organization's needs. Well, we need somebody to start and not chew up our prospects' arms. So we need somebody in low A or high A to be a fourth, fifth starter. So again, these would not be termed prospects, but they have some organizational value in a certain time frame. You go up to the top of that left, and now you have people who are performing well, but they just don't indicate that they have a lot of growth potential. Perhaps it's the way they get the results doesn't suggest they're going to succeed at the major league level. Well, they can perhaps opportunistically fill a roster spot. Somebody goes on the DL, and maybe you call that player up from double A, or oftentimes these players are stashed at triple A to make that 10-day trip up to the majors while somebody is recovering from injury. If you go to the middle column at the bottom, those players you really want to focus. You've said they've got medium potential. They're not getting it done. You know, maybe they're just in their first professional season or half season, and they're not really adjusting well to pro ball. So you want to really give them that personal attention and develop a customized plan to help them realize what you think is their potential. If you jump up to the top, this is where you might have a major league role player or utility player. Someone who you could see come up for half a season. And we all can think of these players that we have in organizations that we follow. If you go all the way over to the right, you've got your top right box, which is the ones you want to fast track to the major leagues. They're getting it done at every level of the minors, and the way they do it, the skills and attributes they have, project much growth. And then if you go one level below that, though, maybe they're only performing at a modest level, but you really know or believe that they have this potential. Well, they've hit a speed bump. They're still high potential. You always need to reassess, continuously assess, but you don't want to lose sight of the things that you that put them all the way in that right column on the first place, so you don't want to give up on those. The lower right, this is an interesting box because maybe you have the person in the wrong position. And I don't know the history of Kenley Jansen, but maybe that's what made him change from catcher to super reliever. But, you know, and I just single him out because he first came to mind as a position change guy. But this is where you might see position changes where you know this person has a lot of qualities to play at the big league level. He's just not getting it done. And it could be a lot of things, one of which could be he's out of position. So just to talk about vocabulary, and then I'm going to talk about hitters and pitchers as two groups here for a moment. But I think of the performance metrics that we're evaluating performance on, that vertical axis, as the what. And think of the potential measures as the how. That's that horizontal axis. So you know, in a general sense, and I'll get more specific on hitters in a moment, the outcome results are the back of the baseball card stats, the situational stats, the splits. Those are the outcomes that are defining performance. Process measures, some of the sabermetric measures, some of the batted ball measures would be process measures that would define performance. And then when you start to look at the horizontal axis, the potential, it's the skills that project growth. And most of those, when I say skills, I'm using the word to mean that these are things that are developed. They're partly innate, but they're largely developed. And then the other group of words I'll use are attributes and traits, which I'm regarding more as a little bit more innate or intrinsic. And yes, they can also be developed, but it's sort of one is 80-20 developed, the other is 80-20 sort of you come to the table with it already. So in the minor leagues, think of performance as similar to how you would judge major league performance, but adjusted for age, league, and level. So, you know, we know leagues obviously have characteristics, and teams all the time would not take somebody, stats out of the California League and judge them the same way you would, another league because of the hitting nature or the pitching nature of a given league. Age is critical. I mean, if someone is a 23-year-old in AA and someone is a 20-year-old in AA, there's tremendous advantages to the 20-year-old in AA if they're performing at the same level. The level itself has impact. You know, when you look at potential, you're really talking about a combination of observations that are data-based or data-based information versus observational measures. You're also looking on the skills, attributes, and traits that are most valued at the major league level. But there's also an organizational philosophy component to this, right? The organization has their own rubric of what a major league player looks like. You heard Andy talking about controlling the strike zone, right? So it's those kinds of organizational philosophy elements that need to fill into the potential category. And the reality is the player needs to exhibit enough in these potential metrics to suggest that he's got stretch. So to get more specific at the hitter level, you know, we're talking about your standard outcome measures. And perhaps the process measures would be things like their exit velo and launch angle and chases and swinging strikes and other batted ball measures. Now you start to say, well, okay, so how do we get to the potential measures? It's really deconstructing this performance into the skills and attributes that got them there and that also are more meaningful as you go up the ladder. So here's an example on the right-hand side of the skills that project success. And this is just my example. I mean, an organization might have a very different set of things in this right-hand column, but I want to dimensionalize it for you. So the ability to get into favorable counts, all right? So what percent of counts does a hitter have that are favorable counts? 1-0 counts, 2-0 counts, 3-1 counts, and so forth. What kind of plate discipline? This is, what Andy was referring to about controlling the strike zone. What about that? Does he show the ability to handle velocity up in the zone? Does he show great pitch recognition? Or what level of pitch recognition would you score him at? Does he have a two-strike approach? Does he appear to have the endurance for a 162-game schedule? I remember talking with a GM, this is probably 8 or 10 years ago, who we were talking about one of his players who was on his major league roster, and I said, you know what, why doesn't he play more? Because he seems to be a quality guy when he's in there, and he was a fairly little guy. And he said he can't play more than 90 to 100 games a year. He doesn't have the stamina for it. He's just not built for it. And so that's something to understand. And some of that can be overcome with training and regimen, but some of that can't. And then again, the ability to make adjustments in game and over the course of the season. So those would be some of the skills you would be looking for in a hitter at a given level of performance to see if he could move to the right on that potential scale. Now I'm going to shift to the attributes. So I just moved the box that was on the far side over, still up there, and I've added the attributes box. So now we're getting into the softer things that will project success. Perhaps it's some of the neuroscience metrics. And we heard Emil yesterday, Sade, say you don't ever draft or make a decision just on the neuroscience aspects. That's why it's fairly far over on the decision, you know, matrix, if you will, on the role it plays. But nonetheless, that stuff is important. That will tell you if a guy is succeeding in high A because of the level of competition, or it might tell you that, no, he's just wired to be able to do things that others can't do because of how he scores on perhaps some of this neuroscience testing. There's the physical, and I could even say physical and medical side, quickness, speed. Does the body suggest injury? And I'll talk a little bit more about this in a few minutes. The mental makeup part, you know, this is where we're talking about, you know, we used the word makeup in the panel yesterday. We used it very, you know, much too broadly. I mean, look at the kinds of things that I've listed here under mental makeup. And some of those have nothing to do with each other, but they're all under the category of, you know, the individual's makeup, if we want to use that word. Resiliency and the ability to cope with failure. We've all heard the phrase, what you fail 70% of the time if you're a hitter in baseball, so you have to have the ability to deal with that. You've seen guys, you know, go through protracted slumps and never recover. You've seen others use it as motivation or as a learning experience to bounce back. The motivation and desire to play and compete. You know, there's a group of players who are so talented, and the game comes so easy to them. They're obviously rare. I guess it doesn't matter that much how much they want to play the game and how much they love the game. But then there's a whole other group of players, most of them, who if they don't have the motivation and are not passionate about playing the game for a living, they probably won't ever realize their full potential or make use of their talent. Level of self-awareness, this is really important. It's those players who understand what their limitations are, understand what their strengths are willing, and that oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes goes hand in hand with learning aptitude and the openness to learn and change and grow. You know, so ability to handle stress. Some players, you know, their heart rate slows down significantly when they get in high pressure situations, and they get this hyper focus and they just live for those moments. Others, you know, freak out in those moments or just perform at least at a lower level because they're distracted or because the game speeds up. Let me jump to the last one and come back to the next to the last. So what about a player's ability to learn and implement change? You know, this, I think, today is one of the hidden inefficiencies in the game, is the ability to assess who, particularly in an information and data-laden era of baseball, it's going to be the players who can use information and adapt more than the ones that just have raw talent. Because today we can find the hole, there's always holes, And, you know, the better you are, the less holes you have, or the harder they are to find. But with the data we have today, I wouldn't believe that we're going to obscure anything anymore. I think we have almost pure transparency on who a player is. So unless they have the ability to adapt to the changes that teams are making, we've seen it in defensive shifts is the most primitive example of this. And we've seen players who just have been baffled and stymied by defensive shifts. We've seen others who have taken that and done things with it and adjusted to it in their own way. So the ability to learn and implement change and the willingness to do it and the want to do it is a critical, I think, success factor for having potential. I mean, does he make his teammates better is sort of an off on the side question. I don't know that speaks directly to his potential, but it is a factor that comes into play when you're looking at filling out your roster. So now let's look at pitchers. Okay, so again, the stats on the left will look obviously very familiar. They're the stats that we typically use to evaluate a player's performance. But if you move over to the right, now we start to look at the way he got his results and the things that might be more indicative of projecting success at higher levels, and that is the ability to get ahead of hitters, the first pitch strikes, fastball command. If you can locate your fastball, a lot of good things can happen. I could have also put up here, how many pitches can you throw off of that first pitch, that primary pitch you have, in the same tunnel that will be hidden and create deception. Ability to create effective sequences. You know, there's more and more work being done today on pitch sequences and the impact it has on hitting and pitching, and I think we're going to see the sequencing being a sort of, wave of the future and a real wave of competitive advantage. It would not surprise me if we have artificial intelligence creating pitch sequences against certain hitters in certain situations sometime in the not-too-distant future. The ability to put hitters away with two strikes. You know, I've seen guys with very high, pretty good swinging strike rates and swing and miss rates with low strikeout rates. They're just not able to put those hitters away. And you've seen the reverse, too. Guys, once they get to two strikes, they're a killer. Pitching every fifth day, back-to-back days for relievers, the ability to take the ball, the ability to stay healthy, the ability to be effective on the mound when you're not 100% because you're going to seldom be 100% over 162 games, and then the ability to make adjustments in-game and over the season, much like it was for hitters. So this is the skills side. Again, we'll slide this over a column, and we'll add the attributes. So the attributes, again, the neuroscience piece, the physical piece for pitchers, the physical medical would be things like repeatable mechanics and, of course, injury risk. The mental, some of that is very much the same. In fact, I guess it's really all the same just from a pitcher's perspective. If you get banged around, are you able to get back on the mound and have the confidence to still throw your fastball somewhere in the zone? Or do you have a breaking ball that you can locate if you're struggling with that? So so the other thing I wanted to mention is, what's the consequences of picking the wrong attributes to rate players on? Well, I'm going to show you a slide on the next page. That's it's an old enough slide that I can do this. It's from 8 to 10 years ago, and it involves. Involved scouting reports from 8 to 10 years ago of an actual major league organization that scouted was their pro scouts were scouting minor leaguers, and you'll see what I'm going to show you is an organization that rated some pitchers that you'll recognize very high on fastball command, but rated them very low as future major leaguers, and this is a classic case of not appreciating the importance of that specific attribute. Some of these pitchers had really low fastball movement, really low velocity, but in the end, they had really high fastball command. So, you know, this is what this organization thought of Dallas Keuchel at one point when he was 22, but he had a very high command rating. Okay, but he had so many other warts on his scouting report that they honestly just didn't believe he had major league potential. So my point is not to beat up this organization who you will never know the name of, but really to say that there are consequences to not understanding the difference of the attributes that project potential versus those that just project performance. So so what skills and attributes, this is sort of, you know, sort of summarizing now, you know, if you have players with similar performance, what are some of the things that could be differentiators? Well, one could be if someone has limited experience in low reps, maybe they're a multi-sport athlete. We heard the story of Mookie Betts yesterday. You know, maybe that's the guy you should give a little extra look at because they just haven't had the experience to master the craft of baseball, be it hitting or pitching or fielding, that some of their peers have, yet they're still performing at the same level. High scores on neuroscience testing, cognitive reaction time, ability to process data in real time, and data and information in real time, those are things that can make a big difference in the future of a player. Physical attributes, the frequency and recovery time from injuries, the a person's flexibility, the absence of degenerative conditions. We've got major leaguers today who are playing with serious forms of arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, Sjogren's disease, and other afflictions that perhaps at age 21 when they were being or 19 when they were being scouted didn't really rear their head. But those are the kinds of things that might shorten a player's career or reduce their effectiveness as they get deeper into their career. And then, of course, the mental, psychological aspects that I've talked about. And I want to go a little deeper about one of them, which is the aptitude for learning. So to break this apart a little bit, it's the ability to make adjustments, the willingness and ability to translate and apply that new information to improve one's performance. I mean, I've heard stories of hitters who have said, you know, when their hitting coach, even at the right time, has said to them, "Let me suggest something to you," and they're like, I can't deal with that much information. Whatever the suggestion is, however simple a form it's put in. So it is important, of course, we talk the player's language, but there are players who just want to block everything else out and go out there and rely on their talent. It's getting tougher and tougher to succeed that way because teams are making adjustments to them. So it's, as I say, the ability to alter one's mental models by adopting new approaches. I mean, I remember talking to a GM a number of years back about his star player who I said, when he's 3-0 and he's 0-2, I can't tell the difference in the way he approaches his at-bat or the way or his swing. He swings exactly the same. And he goes, "Don't you think we've had that conversation with him?" He said, his point is, this is what got him here. He has no interest in developing a two-strike approach. Now, I think we'd get a little different dialogue today, and maybe the general manager would even view it a little differently today. But that was, you know, that was probably 8 or 10 years ago, that conversation. A player having self-confidence in their own decision ability is maybe not something we think about on the playing field, but decisiveness and confidence to make adjustments is something that's really important and, you know, tough to assess. I'm not saying any of this stuff is easy to assess, but I am, you know, saying that I think these are important factors. And then the last thing I'll mention is this you know, capability of trusting coaches. It means you need two things. It means you have to believe that they're knowledgeable enough to offer you insights, and you also have to believe that they legitimately care about you as an individual if you're the player. I remember talking to a pitcher who's an active pitcher today who talked about a pitching coach he had who said he wanted him to do this, and the pitcher said, "Why?" Just not in a nasty tone, just "Why?" And the pitching coach just went off on him. And this pitcher said, "He lost me. It didn't matter what else he ever said to me." And he got traded fairly quickly after that. But you know, it's just today's generation, and it's really kind of human respect. People want to know why. People deserve to know why. You know, you're tampering with this guy's ability to make, you know, a career at a baseball and maybe make $100 million someday, and if you're making telling him to make a change, it'd be good to tell him why. So last slide. So why adopting this this mindset and this nine-box approach could help an organization? Well, number one, perhaps you could be a little less surprised when that player with, we've all seen them, with all the tools in the world fails, which will happen sometimes. It won't always be because they didn't have potential that you could have ferreted out, but it might. Be better at identifying the average minor league performer who has the capacity to succeed at the major league level. There are those players out there. Oftentimes they do find their way through, but not always. And I think there's more of them that don't find their way through because they don't get the attention, they don't get the opportunities, and so forth, because they're written off at an early level just based on pure performance and not so much on some of the attributes and skills we're talking about. Focusing player development resources on those most likely to succeed, not necessarily those performing best at a minor league level. It could impact player selection in the amateur draft, international signings, even prospect rankings. Think about in a trade, if somebody asks for one of two players in a trade, maybe they're performing equally well and that's the only window the opposing scouts have into the player, but you know from all of your deep assessments that you rate them one's here and one's here. Well, now you know if they're indifferent, you're going to give them this player. So it's really, there's so many ways that understanding potential and getting conviction around it will help you add value to your organization. And again, it helps you build a winning and, I think, more important, learning organization with a track record for developing talent. So that's my presentation. I'd be happy to take any questions. David?
Vince, this may relate more to player selection, but I'm thinking about outside influences on a player. For example, a dominant father who's been his coach the entire time he's been playing baseball, a guy who then might, when he gets into trouble the first time he has a failure at late, maybe high A or double A, instead of going to the pitching coach or to the batting, you know, the hitting coach, he's calling dad. I'm not sure whether that's the kind of, you know, for every, let's say, Bryce Harper or Chipper Jones, where you've got a father who's been a real positive, I could name at least one player who was partially out of baseball last year, who's coming back, who's had a reputation as somebody who was resistant to coaching, but always went back to dad.
Yeah.
I'm not sure exactly how an organization, other than not selecting that player, how an organization can deal with that. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, many organizations have found a way to deal with it. You know, we can all think of players who have had that reputation over time. I think it's one of those things where if you think the upside is significant enough, you do find a way to deal with it, while at the same time hoping that you can help transform the player into becoming a little bit more self-reliant. Trevor Bauer has had the reputation of not being particularly amenable to coaching and influencing early in his career. I also think that has a lot to do with the message that was being delivered to him. He's also seems to be an extraordinary learner and someone who is open to influence, but he has his own grounded, rooted principles that he knows are, in his mind, tried and true and are tested. So, you know, I think this is one of those things that's clearly a gray area, and I think there's ways to navigate around it. I think for the, for the sixth round draft pick, it's a tough choice to make to go that route. For the, you know, top 15 pick, you might be able to digest it a little more easily.
Hi, Vince. Good presentation. You kind of addressed my question in your last comment there. But do you think players who are high draft picks or get large bonuses or deemed as a top prospect get a little bit more rope, more coaching, they'll more focus in the organization and they'll hang on to them more than like a Kevin Pillar, who was like a 32nd round draft pick?
Yes, I mean, I think it's natural. I mean, I think you know, you're sort of the baseline slotting and ranking of your system has a lot to do with what they were on your draft board that first year. So now you're going to carve up the opportunities to play in certain. Now, there's only one center fielder in a low A ball club, right? So that's got to go to one person. There's probably two center fielders, but you know what I'm saying? It's limited. So yeah, I mean, I think you're going to divide your slots up that way. It's critical though that organizations, and they do this, is they continuously reassess. Now, where they hold on to that, you know, number four pick overall in the first round because they believe he's the guy, and now we're in his third year of development, you know, maybe it's Mark Appel or somebody like that where it doesn't play out, it's you know, it's important to make those adjustments. And those are difficult decisions the organization has to make because in some ways they're incriminating decisions about the draft pick you make. Not always, though, because there's some things you couldn't have foreseen and you shouldn't be expected to have foreseen. The general manager's got to set the tone and make sure that he's getting honest feedback and that we're not living in the past because we're holding on and protecting our reputations and our jobs. It's an important question, yes, though. Yes, why don't you walk up to the mic?
Thank you for having me. My question is, where do players like Mike Piazza and Orlando Hudson, who were drafted very low, fall into your category?
You know, yeah, I mean, I don't know enough about their assessments at the time, but there's many of them. Those are two examples. I'm trying to think of Albert Pujols was a, what was he, 16th round or something, 13th round? So there's a lot of players in that category, and I'm not sure. Now you're getting a little bit into talent identification in the first place at the amateur level, so I'm not really sure. But, you know, it's important that every organization has those nuggets in them right now, and to find them by parsing performance from potential and trying to separate those out the best way you can and going deep on potential. And there's a lot of this going on, right, with the neuroscience and the medical, the mental skills assessments and mental skills coaching, that it's really, you know, it's really an important question. So I think we're pretty much at the end, but thanks for your time. And what's next, Mark? Brian Reif's research presentation will be in just a moment. Okay, thanks.